meditation and empowers your life. Those five spiritual factories in brief are faith, our energy, our mindfulness, samadhi or letting go, and wisdom, the five spiritual faculties. And we use these things to actually empower our life. We use faith to empower our life because there's much in the world which we do not know. So we need to have some degree of faith, first of all. Some degree of faith, a bit of confidence. But be careful, because when you have faith, you shouldn't give faith too quickly. You should check out the religion. Check out the teacher. Check out the teachings to make sure they make sort of sense. It's called market research. I was just asked why I became a Buddhist by one of the magazines who just interviewed me. That's another reason why I was a bit late. And they asked, why do you become a Buddhist? And I said, when I was 16 years of age, I knew that religion was important. But why should you follow the religion of your parents? Why should you just choose a religion because you were born in that land or in that town? Does that really make sense? Is that really rational? I thought, no. So I went to a bookshop and I got books on all the major religions and I read them all. That is market research. Don't you do that when you choose a car? Don't boys and girls do that when they choose a partner in life? Market research. I did that with my religion, and I chose Buddhism because to me that looked the most sensible religion. It's the one I could get the most faith in for me. And then of Buddhism, I searched out the type of Buddhism which I liked, and eventually when I became a monk, I wanted to do my market research before I chose a country or a monastery I wanted to ordain. So I looked at all the monks which I could find in London at the time. The Thai monks, the Sri Lankan monks, the Burmese monks, the Tibetan monks, the Mahayana monks. And I chose the Thai monks. I ordained in Thailand. And this is true. I became a monk in Thailand because the Thai monks I knew smiled the most. The Tibetans were a close second, but the Thais just beat them by a short head, as they say, not by a short smile, you say, in my reckoning. Because I thought that if religion is worth anything, if I'm going to have faith in this, it's going to work. I want to get something out of this. And I wanted to see the end result. I want to see someone who's been practicing this for a while and to see whether it's worth investing my energy, even my life in. So I was looking around these monks and to see which ones were the miserable ones and which ones were the happy ones. Just like you have these advertisements of soap powder. The old soap powder you used to use does not make your clothes very white. They don't get rid of the smells, but this new wonder soap powder, fresh on the market, not only does it give you your clothes this special whiteness and fragrance, but it solves all your marriage problems as well. That's what happens, I think, on the advertisements. When you don't use the right soap powder, your husband sort of sneers at you. When you get the right soap powder, you're happy ever after. That's the advertising campaign, isn't it? And that's the same sort of thing which I wanted from my religion. I wanted a religion which worked. So I chose the happy monks. And I say today, you'll never get faith in anything if it doesn't work. Would you buy a car which doesn't go, which doesn't work? Would you buy a computer which you turn it on and it always crashes? So why will you choose a religion which always crashes, which never goes, which always goes splatter, splatter, splatter and creates more problems for you? Surely the path has to be tested first of all. Market research. So you do market research before you gain faith in anything. So you research the monk who's sitting up here. You test him out. You go to his monastery. You see, is he like this in everyday life? Or is he just put on his smile just before he comes into the hall? So it's important you check out your monks and teachers. It's important you check out your path. You check out what works and what doesn't work for you. And that becomes your siddha, your faith in your path in life. Once you have that faith, then you really commit yourself to that path. You give it everything you've got. It's called commitment. Maybe before you might have been involved in Buddhism. You may be on the edges, what we call the Waisak Buddhist. You come when there's a big feast to get something to eat. But the rest of the time you stay at home. After a while, when you get faith, you have to commit yourself to a path. You know the difference between involvement and commitment? The difference between involvement and commitment is the same as the difference between bacon and eggs. Do you understand? In bacon and eggs, the chicken's involved, but the pig is committed. Think about it. Bacon and eggs, the chicken's involved, the pig is committed. The chicken only gives an egg. The pig gives his whole life. So when you commit to a religion, you have to commit like a pig. You give your whole life, not just one part of yourself. Now that takes faith, but with that sort of commitment, then you really have faith in your path. You give it yourself wholeheartedly to walk in that path. 90% is not enough. 99% is not enough. 99.9% is still not enough. The minimum is 100%. 101% is also good. Many years ago, an Australian man came to see me in my monastery. He'd been to see my teacher many years ago, and he came back with this story which had changed his life. He'd heard about this famous monk in the northeast of Thailand, Ajahn Chah. He wanted to get some spiritual advice, to ask a master his questions. He had faith in the reputation of my teacher, Ajahn Chah. But unfortunately, when he made the long journey from Sydney to Bangkok, from Bangkok to Ubon, and from Ubon to this master's monastery in the jungle, by the time he got there, he realized that many other people had faith in Ajahn Chah by this time. And Ajahn Chah was surrounded by so many devotees. And this young Australian waited on the outside of the group of people, waited to have a chance to ask his important questions. He'd come all this way. He was prepared to wait. But when 3, 4, 5 hours had gone past, and he was no closer to asking Ajahn Chah, he realized that this monk was just too famous. He would never get close enough to ask his questions. So he got up and left to go home. Disappointed that he'd spent all that money, got all that way, and not been able to see the great master. As he was walking out, he realized that he'd arranged for his taxi to come, but not until another hour had passed. He saw some of the monks were sweeping the monastery grounds. He thought, I might as well make some good karma while I'm here. I've got done nothing else. So he picked up a broom and also started sweeping. It's amazing what happens when you make even small amounts of good karma. He got some instant reward. Because as he was sweeping, he felt someone's hand on his shoulder. He looked around to follow that hand along the arm to the face which was connected to it. That face belonged to Ajahn Chah. It was Ajahn Chah who had seen this Australian come from such a long way, and he decided to go and teach or help this young man who had come so far. However, Ajahn Chah didn't have time to to give a long discourse, not even to answer any of his questions. He just said to this young Australian these words: "If you're going to sweep, give it everything you've got." And then Ajahn Chah turned around and went to the car which was waiting for him to take him to another appointment. Now those words may sound simple to you, but when they come from a great monk, a wise teacher, you realize that they are much deeper than what's on the surface. When he said, whatever you do, or what he said, when you're sweeping, give it everything you've got, he also meant, whatever you do, give it 100%. Give it everything you've got. That Australian understood the meaning. It meant when he went back to work, he gave his job everything he'd got. When it was time to rest, he gave resting, sleeping, everything he'd got. When he played, he gave playing, enjoying himself, everything he'd got. And when he meditated with everything he'd got. That's why he became very successful, both in the world, in his family, and also in his spiritual life. How many of you give everything you've got to anything you do? A lot of the time, we keep something back just in case. We never meditate with everything we've got. We always keep something back. We never work with everything we've got. We never commit ourselves to our partner with everything we've got. We always have the little clause just in case. We have the prenuptial agreements just in case. So, real faith gives you that degree of commitment. So you give everything you've got to the task. You also have faith, Siddhar, not just in the teachings or the teacher. You also have faith in yourself. How many people have got faith in their own ability to succeed? On this retreat, I've been talking about jhanas. These amazing states of bliss, of letting go, a happiness better than sex, which is again more marketing. How many of you think, well, maybe Ajahn Brahm can do those things, but not me? I'm only a housewife. I'm only a doctor. I'm only a lame person. How can someone like me do anything like that? That means you've got a lack of faith. The job of a teacher is to be like a coach of a sports team. Even though Kuala Lumpur soccer team might be playing Manchester United, the coach says, they've only got 11 men, you're 11 men, they've only got 2 legs each, you've got 2 legs each, the ball is round, who knows which way it's going to go? You can do it. You can make it. You can beat them. What sort of coach would say, no way you guys are going to beat this mob? That coach gets a sack. Because upsets sometimes happen. People are not supposed to win. Do succeed. People who don't think they can get enlightened, do get enlightened. Faith, confidence. The Buddha said, the people who can't become enlightened, they're called abhavapugala, incapable beings. Those who can't become enlightened are those who've shed the blood of a Buddha. Have any of you done that in this life? They're ones who have killed an arahat. You killed an arahat? They're ones who have killed their mother or their father. Has any of you done that? They're ones who have created a schism in the Sangha. Has anyone here done that? There's ones who have actually raped a nun. Have any of you done that? Come on, confess. If you haven't done that, or any of those, then there's nothing stopping you from being enlightened in this very life. That's what the Buddha said. Who knows, that enlightened one can be you. I'm encouraging you. You don't know how near or how far you are. The Buddha gave this wonderful, inspiring simile. It's like having a water pot taller than a person's head. You can see the water dripping in. Drip, drip, drip. But you can't see how much water is already in the jar. You can't tell whether one more drip can make the water jar overflow. You just don't know. Maybe just one more meditation and your water jar overflows. Maybe you too could be an arahat, enlightened being, in this very evening. Who knows? Some people say, I don't want to be. I've got to go to work next week. What would my husband say? But you don't know how close you could be. That's faith and confidence. Confidence in your own ability to succeed. For those of you who are meditators, there was one man who had very great difficulty in meditating on the breath. He could never find his breath. When he did find it, he lost it straight away. Only maybe one in-breath, and he was wandering away. Someone told him, if you can't watch your breath, imagine you're watching your breath. Imagine what it'd be like to watch your breath. Sit down, close your eyes, and imagine doing breath meditation. When he did that, he closed his eyes and he imagined watching his breath. After 2 or 3 minutes, the teacher said, what are you doing? He said, actually, I'm not imagining it, I'm doing it. What's the difference between imagining and doing? For him, there was no difference. He didn't think he could do it. It was a trick to show that he could do it. All it was a lack of confidence, a lack of faith. Isn't that the case with many kids at school? They don't think they can succeed, so they don't succeed. We have faith in ourselves. One of the stories which I found out, a classic experiment in educational psychology carried out in the UK many years ago, in the times when they had streams in the school, class A, class B, class C, class D, class E. The top kids being in class A, those who didn't do so well being in class E. In this one particular school, they had just 2 classes in that 1 year. At the end of the year, they gave those 2 classes the same exam. And they never published the results. It was only the headmistress and 2 psychologists realized what was going on. Because the child who came top was put in the same class as the children who came 4th and 5th, 8th and 9th, 12th and 13th. The children who came 2nd and 3rd were put in the same class with the ones who came 6th and 7th, 10th and 11th, and so on. They split the classes up as evenly as possible based on that exam. They gave the 2 classes teachers who they thought were equally able. They gave classrooms which they thought had equal facilities. They made everything as equal as possible except for one thing. They called one class A and the other one class B. Even though they were completely equal, only 3 people knew. Some of the parents saw their lazy, good-for-nothing son who did no homework going class A. I don't know how you did this, but carry on. Here's an extra few dollars. Well done. Some parents saw their child, even though they're working hard, went in class B. They took away their privileges. You have to do harder next year. No soccer for you. No going out. No computer games. Work. Because the parents thought class B meant they'd done badly in the exam. Even the teachers assumed that Class A was the top half, and they taught as if they were Class A. The other teachers taught as if this was the bottom half. After 1 year of this, they gave an examination at the end of the year. Those children in Class A, even though they're exactly the same as those in Class B, because of 1 year of being called Class A children, they did so much better in the exam. They actually became Class A kids. Those children in Class B, they lived down to their reputation and became Class B kids. That's what psychology is like. If you consider your husband a Class B husband, he will become a Class B husband. If you think of yourself a Class B meditator, then you will be a dumb meditator. So faith and confidence is actually giving yourself the benefit of the doubt. If you think you can succeed, you do succeed. That is called faith, confidence. The confidence which a coach gives you to excel in what your field of endeavor. And here we're excelling in meditation. That is confidence, that is faith, without which you never excel either in your worldly life or your spiritual life. For those of you who think meditation is hard work, for those of you who think being secretary of the BGF is hard work, for those of you who think that giving donations is hard work, always remember that the Buddha said, what is bad is easy to do. What is hard, so what is good is hard to do. What is bad is easy to do. What is good is hard to do. That's from the Dhammapada. So if it's hard work, it must be good. So work hard, because you've got faith. And that faith in your own abilities, in the teacher, in the teachings, in your path, gives you energy. If you have no faith, where can energy come from? If you don't think you can succeed, why would you try? If you think you're incompetent, why ever get out of bed in the morning? It's all going to go wrong, I know it, so I better stay in bed. Now that type of dullness and sleepiness and tiredness and lack of energy comes from a lack of faith. So those in the spiritual path, whatever path you choose, once you've got faith, you'll find you've got energy. You've got energy to get up in the morning. Because you've got faith that this could be my day. This could be the day when I get into jhanas. This can be the day when I get enlightened. I better get up. Zippity-doo-dah. What a wonderful day. The human life is precious, said the Buddha. It's rare to get the opportunity to be reborn as a human, to meet the Dhamma, to be able to practice the Dhamma. This is your chance. You can sleep when you're in your coffin as much as you like. So it gives you the energy to get up there and practice. The faith leads to energy. But many people don't know how to use energy. When we have energy, it doesn't mean we get frantic. It doesn't mean that we go around like a Buddha in a china shop. Energy gets directed through the power of faith. The energy knows where to work and what to do. There is a time when energy stands still. The motionless energy, like a cat who's full of energy waiting for the mouse. I don't know if this is a very good Buddhist simile, but Ajahn Chah used it, so what the heck. Like a cat waiting for the mouse. The cat is all poised to pounce. Its muscles tense, its tendons stretched, ready, full of energy. But it doesn't move, it waits. When the mouse comes close, it's still motionless. The mouse comes closer, it still doesn't move. The mouse comes closer, and it pounces, and gets the mouse. Like a coiled up spring full of potential energy. Whenever there's something to do, it does it. And what does a cat do after it's got the mouse? It curls up in meditation. It's still, it rests, and it enjoys its lunch. Now what do human beings do? Sometimes you've got energy and you waste it. You're wasting doing things you don't need to do. Do you need to think about tomorrow? No. You might not survive until tomorrow. Life and death are uncertain things. Why is it we plan and we think? We don't live to see our plans. Or the plans all go wrong. You know what? I think I said this the other day. Once I had a dentist appointment when I was young. I hated going to the dentist. I was scared. I lost sleep that night. But when I got to the dentist surgery, I found my appointment had been cancelled. Oh, what a fool I felt, but I learnt my lesson. Why waste energy on the future, which is so uncertain? Those of you who have done exams at school, do you worry? Am I going to fail? Am I going to succeed? Who cares? If you succeed, you only have to do another exam afterwards. If you fail, that's the end of exams. Whoopee! And if you can't get a job, you can always become a monk. Or a nun. So, what's the big deal? Why worry? Why put all that energy and waste it into worrying about things which you don't know what's going to happen? I never knew what was going to happen to me. I never thought I'd become a monk sitting up here giving talks in Malaysia to so many people. I became a monk to have a bit of peace and quiet. And what happens? People spend all day telling me their problems. I became a monk to get rid of problems. And now people come and tell me their problems. But Ajahn Chah, my great teacher, said that's part of the duty of being a monk. He said as a monk is like a dustbin. And people come sometimes at all hours of the night and they dump their rubbish in you. Complaining about their husband. Complaining about their wife. Complaining about their kids, complaining about their parents, complaining about their financial situation. I've got no money. It's a waste of time coming to ask me some help. I don't know anything about money. But my teacher said, be a dustbin as a Buddhist monk, but be a dustbin with a hole in the bottom. So you don't keep anything. So whatever energy you do, you don't allow that energy, good energy or bad energy, to actually to create lack of energy or negativity. You don't keep problems. You let them go. When you do this out of faith, you have energy. You focus that energy. And as we say in meditation, all the energy of those spiritual faculties, you don't waste into trying to change things which you cannot change, meaning the present moment. It's already here. You can't do anything with it. So leave it alone. The door of my heart is open to this present moment. Come in. You don't change what you're experiencing. Instead, you put all that energy into the knowing. The energy flows not into trying to change the world, not into trying to change yourself, not into trying to become enlightened. But the energy all goes into knowing what's going on. It's like in these houses where someone has got only one socket in their house, and they've got all these adapters, so they take all the energy off and your light becomes dim, because the energy is always being used in the computer, in the television, in the vacuum cleaner, in the air conditioner, and there's no light left, there's no energy left for the light to read your book. Imagine turning the computer off, turning the aircon off, turning the TV off, turning the vacuum cleaner off, the dishwasher. Then all that energy can flow into the light of knowing. This is what happens when we channel our energy, not into changing the world, but into finding out this world we're trying to change. Knowing gets energized. Strange thing happens when the energy flows into the knowing. You get what's called the third spiritual faculty, mindfulness. Some people think they're mindful, but they're not. Some people are drunk. You ever seen a drunken person? You ask them, are they drunk? I'm not drunk. They stay staggering down the road. A drunk person never knows they're drunk. A person's not mindful. They don't know they're not mindful. But people think they're mindful. They've just got a small light and they're not really seeing what's going on. That's why people don't know the truth. They don't know the world. They don't know themselves. That's why people make mistakes. Like walking through the forest with a very, very dull flashlight. You tend to trip over things. I remember one morning, I think I said this today somewhere. One morning, no, I think it was this afternoon, for those of you who didn't hear this. One morning when I got up, my mindfulness wasn't very strong. It almost got me into big trouble, serious trouble. I went into the forest to urinate. I thought I was peeing on a snake, on a stick. And when the stick started to wriggle, I realized it was a snake. I'd urinated on a snake. Fortunately, the snake must have had some loving kindness to me, because it didn't go and bite me. I think I deserve to be bitten, don't you? Somebody said perhaps it appreciated having a warm bath in the early morning. It's a dangerous thing to do, not to be recommended. It was only because my mindfulness wasn't clear that I urinated on a snake. There's a big snake too. So, sometimes that's what life is like. Through our lack of mindfulness, we urinate on things we shouldn't be urinating on. And because of that, we get into big trouble. That's what happens when our mindfulness isn't strong. But through faith, through energy, through focusing all of that energy into mindfulness, we become alert. We become awake. We become alive. Are you alive? Are you really, or are you half asleep? Most people live their life half asleep. They say that you only use a tenth of your brain. That's not enough, is it? If you're alive, you use all of your faculties. You're alert, you're awake, you're living life. Do you like life? How many of you love life? You know me too well by now. Every time I ask you a trick question, you don't fall into it anymore. Yeah, you only love half of life, the nice part. The other part we'd rather not have. That's why we block our mind from the part we don't like. sickness and death. Failure, when things go wrong, we don't like to be mindful of that part. We don't love life, we only like the nice part. And we block ourselves off from the other part. That's what we're not mindful. We don't understand what life really is. We only understand what we want life to be. When energy goes into mindfulness, we get this strong mind which can see deeply into things. I always had strong mindfulness when I was young. I never realized it must be from a past life, because when I was doing examinations, even in primary school, I not only remembered the correct answer to the question, I also remembered when the teacher told us that in school. My memory was very sharp. All of those who want to succeed in the world, memory is important. If you're paying attention to what's being said, if you're fully mindful of what's happening, if all your energy is going to the knowing and not into the writing down, caught you out again. If all the energy is going into the knowing instead of the writing down, you're paying full attention, then you remember. It's incredible if you pay attention how much you recall what's happening. In a car crash. Have you ever been in a car crash? When time starts to go slow, you become very mindful, you become very alert, because your life is being threatened. It's danger. And you always remember those incidents. It's called trauma. You're alert, you're awake. Fully alert, and that's why you always remember it. Imagine when you were at school, if you had that same sort of mindfulness as before a car crash, then you'd always pass your exams 100%, because you're alert, awake, you remember that. If those of you want to increase your power of memory, you don't need to pay hundreds of ringgits to go to this, what was it, Sylvan Mind Control, or increase your memory. You can come to the SBJA and SJBA Buddhist Center on an evening and you can get this for free. How to have a good memory is be mindful. But not only have a good memory, strange things happen when you put energy into your knowing and take it away from your doing. When you feel alert, awake, energized, you also feel happy. One of the insights of Buddhism is that energy, you know what Einstein says? E equals MC squared. Energy equals happiness squared. You become happy when you have energy. When you wake up in the morning and you're dull and lethargic, are you happy? No, I don't want to get out of bed again. Another day on retreat. Another day I'm sitting and snoring, nodding. What am I doing this for? And I've paid money for this. Oh, what a fool I am. When you're lethargic, you've got no energy, you've got no happiness either. That's why I say, all you meditators, tomorrow morning, you're all in the same room, so one of you do this, so everyone else does the same. When it gets the time to get up, 5 o'clock, jump out of bed, throw your arms in the air, but be careful not to hit anybody, and say, zippity-doo-dah, what a wonderful day, another day of retreat. When you put energy into the morning, you become happy. Other people might think you're mad, but that's their problem. Whatever you put energy into, you get happy. I put energy into my talks, that's why I'm happy. I put happiness into myself, that's why I've got energy. Happiness is energy. So you put energy into whatever you're doing, and you get happiness. That's the secret of happiness. Energy. So, you've already developed that energy through faith, gives rise to energy, gives rise to mindfulness. That mindfulness is a happy mindfulness. When you have a happy mindfulness, whatever you wish to do, you can stay with it. You are happy to be here. Are you having a good time? You enjoying the talk today? That's why no one has moved and left. If I gave the most boring talk, you'd be out that door going somewhere else. I'm not coming to listen to this. If you're happy, you stay still and you pay attention. Have you ever noticed that? So, once is happiness, then is attention and stillness. That gives rise to samadhi, the next spiritual faculty, the ability to be still, not to move, to hold your attention without it going anywhere. It's called peace of mind. Do you want peace of mind? Peace of mind is not found in the middle of the night when you're asleep. That's not peace of mind. You're still dreaming. You're still tossing and turning. That's not any peace at all. The other place you find peace of mind, usually in most countries, the only place where you find people resting in peace is their cemetery. But here in Malaysia, we also have, in Subang Jaya Buddhist Association, all our yogis resting in peace while they're still alive. Isn't that wonderful? How could you rest in peace when you're happy to be here? You don't want to go anywhere else. That's where you rest in peace. That is the secret of Buddhist meditation. Happiness. That's why I've all this retreat, I made a big thing of making this a happy retreat. I told our meditators that usually we give the photographs of the retreat at the end of the retreat, because in most retreats which are pain and torture, that's the only time when the yogis look happy, just before they go home. They're looking forward to their evening meal. They're looking forward to their television. They're looking forward to their comfortable chairs and soft beds. But in my retreats, at the end of the retreats, people look miserable, because they have to go home to that business. They have to get up and go to work tomorrow. They've got to face their wife, their husband. In the poems of the enlightened nuns in the time of the Buddha, many of the enlightened nuns told these amazing poems. They recollected their life when they were housewives, and they said one of the joys of monastic life is having given up the three crooked things. You know what those three crooked things are? The first crooked thing was the ladle they used to make the curry. That was a symbol for housework, for cooking. They said as a nun, there's no more cooking. Oh, what joy. They've given up the first crooked thing, the ladle. The second crooked thing they'd given up was the broom which they used to clean the house. There's a symbol of all the other housework they needed to do. They'd given up the second crooked thing, the broom. And they'd also given up the third crooked thing. You know what that was? The husband, yeah. Oh, what joy, they've given up the three crooked things. That's the end of sutras. So all of you, you're going home on Thursday or Friday back to your three crooked things. So happiness gives rise, you want to be here. How many people in life really want to be here? How many people are happy to be here? And how many want to go somewhere else? Isn't for most people life always wanting to be somewhere else? Or when you're at work, wanting to be home. When you're at home, wanting to go in front of the TV. When you're at the TV, wanting to go to the toilet. We always want to be somewhere else. Even when we're living, when we're working, we want to be retiring. When we're retiring, we want to die and go to heaven. We always want to be somewhere else. How many people are happy to be here? Very, very rare to see someone who's content to be where they are. We're always on the run, always moving, never happy with what we've got. When you develop mindfulness, you develop happiness. When you develop happiness, you develop the ability to be where you are. To be content. When you develop contentment, you develop stillness. When you develop stillness, you develop samadhi. Not only the world becomes still, your body becomes still. Not only your body becomes still, your mind becomes still. The whole world stops moving. You find what real peace is like. There are many different levels of peace. I've been telling our meditators, in your meditation, do you make peace or do you make war? Those who make war try to conquer their mind. They have a battle with themselves. They fight campaigns against their defilements. They're at war. They don't make peace. And when you make war, there's a lot of collateral damage. Headaches, stress, disappointment, frustration. That's the collateral damage of making war with your mind. But when we have this stillness, when you're at peace, you're not making war anymore, you're making peace. And peace grows, peace upon peace upon peace. And if you get lots of pieces, the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle fit together, and that's called wisdom. That's a good way of getting on to the next spiritual faculty of wisdom. There are many different pieces fitting together into the jigsaw of life. But no, you understand what peace really means. Peace, ultimate happiness. You heard me say before, I think in KDU, the five questions of the five children playing the wishing game. The ultimate wish was not an infinity of wishes. Did I tell that story? If I had a wish, I would wish for three wishes. My first wish, I'd get an ice cream factory. My second wish, $1 billion US. For my third wish, I'd have another three wishes. That way, he had as many wishes as he could possibly want. Can you be happier than that? Than having all the wishes in the world? And the fifth child said, I wish, if I had a wish, I wish I was so content I never needed any more wishes. The contentment so you don't need any more wishes. The freedom from desires. That child won the wishing game. That child won the human race. The race towards happiness. He knew the end of craving. Real peace. And that is the wisdom which everybody wishes for in life. Fulfillment, peace, rest. To be so content, so at ease, you don't need any more wishes. How much money do you need to retire? The answer is nothing. I retired when I was 23. Without any money, without any pension fund, without any shares or gold bars. And I've been very happy for a long time. Now this is what wisdom teaches you. Wisdom teaches what you really want in life is not what you need. What you need is to stop the wanting and to be at peace at last. When you know that, then that is called wisdom. Those are the five spiritual faculties in brief. Faith, energy, mindfulness, samadhi, peace, and wisdom. I've shown them as a sequence, one leading to the other, which leads to the next, and which culminates in the wisdom of enlightenment itself. They're both a path, and they're what propel us along the path. Some people say you should balance those faculties. That is wrong. You do not find that teaching anywhere in the suttas. It comes from the commentaries, and I said earlier, the commentaries are books that are written by people who couldn't meditate. Anyone who writes a book, remember? What's the karmic result of writing a book? The next seven lifetimes you get reborn as a donkey. I hope there's no authors here. Now, you see that the real peace comes from this progress. You don't need to balance these faculties. You can't have too much energy. You can't have too much faith. You can't have too much mindfulness. You can't have too much samadhi. You can't have too much wisdom. You don't balance these things. You increase the amplitude as much as you can. You increase your faith as much as you can. You increase energy as much as you can. You increase mindfulness as much as you can. You increase your samadhi, the ability to be still. And you increase your peace as much as you can until there's no limit to those things. When you see the Dhamma, your faith is unshakable. It gets to its peak when you attain to stream winning. Then you bow down to the Buddha with tears in your eyes, because you understand what the Buddha is. You've seen the Buddha. The one who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha. The stream winner has seen the Buddha, seen the Dhamma. To know what that means, you have to get there. There you have real faith. You know the value of this path. This is the best thing you could have ever done in your whole life. This is a happiness that exceeds not just sex, everything. Nothing counts compared to the happiness of release. Peace of mind. Not just the sheer bliss of it, but the sense of freedom. The ultimate happiness. The goal. The treasure, the miracle you found. Peace at last. When the Buddha became enlightened, he was so blissed out he didn't even blink his eyes for 7 days. It says that. I can understand that. That's truth. So bliss, so powerful. My goodness. It's bliss which you cannot imagine. The happinesses of the world are nothing compared to the happinesses of a monk. You guys don't know what you're missing. So people think being a monk is so hard. Being a monk is so difficult. You can't do this, you can't do that. I don't want to do this, I don't want to do that. I'm having a good time. I'm saying, this is great being a monk. Anyone want to join? So this is, you get incredible bliss. You can't get too much bliss. Some people say, Ajahn Brahm's just attached to that bliss. The Buddha said, these are blisses which are born of letting go. You cannot be attached to letting go. It's impossible. You cannot be attached to giving. You either give or you're attached. You can't do both. You can't be attached to precepts. Precepts are letting go. You're only attached when you break precepts. Stealing is attachment. Killing is attachment. All of the precepts, when you break them, is because of attachment, not because of letting go. You can't be attached to compassion. Compassion is letting go of selflessness, selfishness. You're being selfless. That's compassion. Compassion comes from when you forget about yourself to help others. When you give your time, this moment, your life to somebody else. It's compassion, it's letting go. And meditation is all about letting go. You can't be attached to letting go. So any of the blisses which come from those practices, the happiness you get from giving, enjoy that, indulge in that, celebrate that. If you feel good because you've given a donation, you deserve that, you can attach to that as much as you like. Then there's a good chance you'll give another donation, that's why I say it. If you are keep your precepts and you feel happy because of that, that's good. Enjoy that, and that will keep you doing more precepts. You start with the 5 precepts, this feels good, this is fun. So let's get a few more. Yeah, let's go for it. 8 precepts. Wow, this is really getting good. If 8 precepts are good, I wonder what 10 precepts are like. Novice ordination. Yeah, marvelous. You can't get enough precepts. Give me more, 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 more. It's not attachment. This is wisdom. Understanding the happiness of letting go. And when you meditate, there you really let go. You get more pleasure. The Buddha said, Pasadika Sutra, I said this the other night, if you become attached to the jhanas, the pleasure of the jhanas, this is what happens, what the Buddha said, of what happens if you indulge in the jhanas. He said you can expect 4 things and only 4 things. This is the result, the karmic consequences of indulging in the pleasure of deep meditation. The first karmic consequence is being a stream winner. The second karmic consequence is being a once returner. The third is being a non-returner. The fourth is being a fully enlightened arahat. There's only 4 consequences you get from indulging in the jhanas. Not bad, is it? Not only do you have a great time, you get these great results afterwards. I say if you indulge in the pleasures of sex, you get babies. If you indulge in the pleasures of jhana, you get enlightenment. Take your choice. I know which one I'm going for. So, these are the 5 faculties. You can build them up as much as you like. But be careful with the first one, because faith, that's a dangerous one. Because that's a gamble. At first, you don't really know what's going on. We have to take it on trust, so check it out. Be wise. Do some market research. Ask the questions. Look and see. If the goal is enlightenment, if the goal is happiness, check out your teachers. Are they having a good time, or are they misery guts? So that's how you can gain faith. You look at the meditators who come to Subang Jaya Buddhist Association. Are they happy? When you send your husband to some meditation, listen to a dharma, does he come back a better husband? If he don't, then it's not a good place to send him, is it? Would you send your child to a school which makes them worse? So, check him out, market research, see what works. If it leads to greater peace, happiness, wisdom, freedom, harmony, it must be the dharma. If it leads to more strife, more arguments, less happiness, that's not the teaching of a Buddha. Do not follow it. So these are the 5 spiritual faculties. These are what guides the life, describes the path to enlightenment, and empower us. Whatever we do in our life, give it faith and confidence in what you're doing. Yes, you can succeed if you believe in yourself. Yes, you can get that energy from that faith. Build up that energy. The more energy, the better. But put it into the knowing. Alertness. Because that's where happiness comes. Knowing clearly. Let go of the doing. Put it in the knowing. Then the mindfulness. Not ordinary mindfulness. Then you become bright. You see deeper into things than the ordinary person. You become like Superman with his X-ray vision. You can see deeply in to what other people just cannot see. And it's like that. This is where you get the superpowers. You become a superhero, just like the Incredible Hulk, only not angry. Just like Spider-Man, only much more wise. This is where you become powerful, and that power is on stillness. And that stillness gives you the incredible wisdom of a Buddha. That's there for you in this very life. Open the doors of the deathless. There is no entrance fee except for you. That's the talk this evening on the five spiritual faculties. Hope you enjoyed that. Any questions on the five Indriya spiritual faculties? Any questions now? Yes, thank you. It's always got the same questioners. Come on, look, you know that if you don't ask questions in this life, you'll be born stupid in your next life. We need more than two professors in our Malaysian universities in our next class. So far, we've only got two. Yes. Yes, please do, yes. 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 Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Because you see, I've got a storehouse here, so I make enough to keep my store, and I keep getting into this all day long. You're like a pelican who keeps. A lot of the energy. If you eat too much, you get tired. You don't have energy. If you eat the right amount, that's where you get energy. There are two types of food, health food and junk food. There are two types of food for the mind, health food for the mind and junk food for the mind. If you take too much junk food for your body, you get sick. If you get too much junk food for the mind, you get sick. In your mind, you get angry, depressed, upset, grief, fed up with yourself, depressed, because you eat junk food in your mind. If you eat health food in your body, you get very fit and healthy, you can do a lot. If you have health food for the mind, you get happy and peaceful. We all know what health and junk food is for the body. What is junk food for the mind? TV. That is called junk food for the mind. Soccer. Junk food for the mind. Movies, junk food for the mind. Music, most music is junk food for the mind. What is health food for the mind? It begins with D. Dhamma, yeah. That is health food for the mind. So you're at a health camp here. I'm teaching you health food techniques for the mind to make you fit and healthy. So this is nature's way, health food, the Dhamma way. So does that answer your question? You have the energy because you have a lot of health food for the mind. Any next question? Yes, quick. Someone give me a chance to be a professor in your next life. Is academic health food for the mind or junk food for the mind? You know, just that most professors don't know what they're talking about. It's true, they go to each other's conferences. No, it's a lie to each other. I've lost so many professors. There was one professor I was very impressed with. He was a professor of medicine at Royal Prince Alfred Hospital in Sydney. It was told to me by a doctor who was a GP in Sydney. He remembered this fellow when he first went to medical school. This head of the whole medical school gave the introductory lecture to all the students. The professor was about to retire, and so he decided to be honest. He told his group of wide-eyed young students beginning their years of study in medicine, he said, "Welcome to this medical school. 50% of what we're going to teach you in the next 6 or 7 years is wrong." Our problem is we do not know which 50% it is. It was only about 6 or 7 years ago that happened. It's lovely to see someone being honest about medicine. In 20 years' time, 50% of what they say works now will be proved to be wrong. And the thing is, we don't know yet what that 50% is. And that's in medicine. I was in science, one of the hard sciences, theoretical physicist. And I just noticed what stupidity went on in Cambridge, in a Rutherford laboratory. Egos were so strong that we had this saying, the eminence of a great scientist is measured. The eminence of a great scientist is measured by the length of time they obstruct progress in their field. So much truth to that. Because of the egos and the pride. They say, this is my theory, and it is right. Even though all the evidence says no, because they got a Nobel Prize for this. This is their theory. They even give their names to it, and they stop progress. That can't be right, because they become experts. You've got to be careful. The eminence of a great monk can sometimes be measured by the length of time he obstructs progress in your meditation. Do not believe what I say. You test it out for yourself. So you've got to be careful there. So this is actually academia. It's all academic. In other words, it's all in the realm of thinking and thoughts and ideas. The reason why I gave up academia, when I didn't pursue further research, was because I looked at those professors at Cambridge. I couldn't see one which was really happy, which was at peace and at ease with himself. They were going through divorces, depression, anxiety. And I thought, what's the point of science? What's the point of having all that intelligence, so-called intelligence, if you're having such a miserable time, if you have no happiness? Surely, anyone who's smart, anyone who's wise, anyone who's intelligent will give themselves the gift of happiness, first of all. What's the point of a Nobel Prize if you're depressed? What's the point of being wealthy if you can't sleep at night? What's the point of being famous if you have to have Valium or these other drugs to actually to get by? Like so many famous people you read about in the papers are having to do today. How many famous people do you know are really happy people? Very, very few. That's why that's not what I wanted. So academia was not attractive to me at all. I'd rather like to go down and find out who I am, not who they tell me I am. Any next question? Yeah. Okay, what is your advice if you're a family person and you want to be a monk or a nun and you've got young children? You left it a bit too late. Because once you have a child, you've got to look after your kids. Personally, in my monastery, I would not allow anyone to become a monk if they've got young children. If they can't commit themselves to their family, they're not going to commit themselves to monastic life. Monastic life is duties as well. It takes a lot of letting go and giving up. So if you've got young children, give up to those young children. Let go and do your duties. Give everything you've got to your task of being a husband and a father. That is your practice. And if there comes a time when your children get old enough to look after themselves, and you have enough to look after your wife, then you can become a monk. When you've set your family up and you're free of your duties. Otherwise, not only do you give monkhood a bad reputation, but you won't succeed.
Yes.
Okay, you're asking, Venno Sariputta became a stream winner when he heard just one monk say these amazing verses. He saw this Asaji. And the reason why he went up to see Asaji, because of Asaji's countenance, his smile, his happiness, his peace. I keep on saying that that is a marketing tool of any religion. The happiness and the peace. That was inspired Sariputta to go and ask the question. And when Asaji told him, then Sariputta got the amazing faith in the Buddha. You say it was Sariputta meditating before. Before he did that, Sariputta was with Sanjaya Balatatisaputta or something like that. He was already a samana, someone who had left the world. He was already keeping precepts. He was already meditating. Now this was the icing on the cake. Somebody asked me this today, earlier. They say, but some people in the suttas, they became enlightened just by hearing the Buddha. Surely that means you don't need to meditate. Everyone wants the easy way. Now I've been to many people's houses, and I've seen a picture on their wall of when they got their degree, dressed in their gown, and somebody famous is handing them degree. And I've said to them, is that all you need to get a degree? To go to some big hall or wear a fancy robe and get this piece of paper from a famous person? Because that's all I see. That's the only time I see they get their degrees. So no, no, no. We had to go to lectures. We had to do assignments. We had to do exams. It took many, many years. But I never see those pictures on the wall. But it doesn't mean it didn't happen. That's a cause. All of that study, all of those assignments, all of that work that led up to that one moment when a famous person handed you the scroll of paper in front of your parents and your delighted family. When you see in the suttas someone get enlightened because of the words of the Buddha, that's like when they got handed the scroll by a famous person. It doesn't recount all they went through before then. All the meditation, all the precepts, all the sometimes the struggle when they didn't understand what was going on. We don't record that because we only want to see that final wonderful moment when you get handed the scroll of enlightenment by the Buddha. All of those people like Bahiya, whom the Buddha said to see, in the seen will be just the seen, in the heard just the heard. That was just the final moment of his quest. He'd meditated before. He kept precepts before. That fellow had psychic powers. He could travel halfway along across India in one night. He could only do that through deep, powerful meditation. That is why the Buddha said, the way to enlightenment. There is only one path to enlightenment. That's called the Eightfold Path. You might call it Vipassana, four Satipatthanas, but as I said today, that is the same as Anapanasati. In the Anapanasati Sutta, the Buddha said, if you do Anapanasati, if you fulfill Anapanasati, you fulfill the four Satipatthanas. So, in this retreat, we've been focusing on Anapanasati. Those of you who fulfill the Anapanasati, you've done Satipatthana. This has been a Satipatthana retreat. This is Vipassana. Probably doing the breath, yeah, it's the same. Samatha and Vipassana are the same. Those of you on this retreat have been practicing Sila Samadhi Panya, the precepts, Samadhi and wisdom. You've been practicing the Bodhisattva precepts. The way of the Bodhisattva, the six paramis, Sila Samadhi Panya, and three more. You know it doesn't matter what you call it. If it's the Eightfold Path, that is Buddhism. So you've been practicing Mahayana. I've been practicing Mahayana this last few days. I've been practicing Vipassana. I've been practicing Theravada. I've been practicing Anapanasati. I've been practicing Samatha. I've been practicing Vipassana. I've been practicing compassion. I've been practicing letting go.
They're all the same. The path of the Buddha. Isn't it wonderful to bring everything together? Any other question? Yeah? Aha. If the future is uncertain, how much should one give to planning your children's future? How many of you try to plan your children's future? Those people whose children left home, did they fulfill your plans? I know I didn't fulfill my parents' plans. They never expected me to become a monk. They never planned for this at all, but actually they were quite happy. So you can have tentative plans. But the best plans are the things you can always adapt to changing situations and circumstances. The people who get frustrated and upset and angry are those people who can't adapt to changing circumstances. Have tentative plans, but not firm plans. Don't have those plans cast in concrete. Have them cast in rubber. All plans should be the same. Even business plans. If you have a strong business plan which you don't adapt to changing situations, you are going to go bust. As a businessman, you've got to be really alert, mindful to the changing economic climate, to the opportunities which come very quickly. And if you're not alert, you'll miss them. You've got to be adaptive, resourceful, able to change. Otherwise, you'll never succeed in life, in your business. You've got to, as a wife, you've got to be adaptive. To see the changing fortunes in your husband, adapt accordingly. Otherwise, you'll be seeing the divorce lawyer next week. Be careful, be adaptive, be resourceful. It's amazing what you can do. There's a story told me about this woman who was giving marriage counseling. This woman came to see her. She said, "My husband stays out late at night. He says he's at the office, but I don't believe him. He doesn't care about me. We've got no real warmth in our relationship, no love at all." And the marriage counselor said, "Well, if it's like that, you should divorce him." She said, no, I don't want to divorce him. That'll make him happy." So this very wise counselor said, "Okay, try this. Try and find out what he likes. Try and dress yourself up. Get a good beauty makeover. Get some nice scent. Get some new clothes. Wear makeup. And be so nice to him. Because you want to get him to fall in love with you again. Because this is the plan. If you have nice makeup, really nice to him, give him nice meals, then he'll like you again. And when he falls in love with you, then you can divorce him." And he said, yeah, I'll do that. So she followed that plan of action. She spent some money, got some nice clothes, did herself up, had a nice hairdo, and it was really nice, and it worked. He started coming home earlier. He started getting very fond of her, and he started getting very nice to her. And this lady, the counselor, knew this, because every 2 weeks she'd come for her session. But then she stopped coming for her counselling sessions. And the counselor wondered what was going on. And so she rang this lady up at home. She said, "How's it going? Is he staying home longer?" "He said, he's staying home longer. Is he coming home earlier?" "He's coming early." "Is he being more kind of friendly to you?" "Yeah, he's coming home really early. She's friendly to me now. He's loving to me." And the counselor said, "Now's the time to divorce him." She said, "Oh, no. It's so nice now." That was great psychology of how to stop people being divorced. If you're adaptive as a wife, then you can bring your husband back again. If you're adaptive as a husband, you can keep your wife.